Good evening, everyone. My name is Jim Moeller, and thank you for joining us this evening. Just briefly, I serve on three different committees in the House. I serve on healthcare, on commerce and workforce, excuse me, labor and workforce development, and on transportation. I also briefly serve on rules, which is mostly a gatekeeping process in the House. But those are primarily my committee assignments, and look forward to hearing your questions.
This is Sharon Wiley. I serve on the Higher Education Committee, the Technology and Economic Development Committee, and I'm Vice Chair of a committee on government accountability, which is dealing with the liquor initiative of a couple of years ago and the marijuana initiative that we just passed.
Hello, everyone. This is Senator Annette Cleveland, and I appreciate all of you joining us tonight. You know, I'm the new legislator here in Olympia. I've just spent my first 12 weeks in the legislature. Very busy. They've been very productive weeks. I have been seated on the healthcare committee, the education committee, and the energy and environment committees, and I'm particularly excited about my committee assignments because I feel that they do complement well my past work experience. And as you well know, I came here ready to be a strong advocate for the 49th Legislative District and for the City of Vancouver. And my focus is always on building, supporting, maintaining healthy communities. And I see key pillars of a healthy community as being access, quality education, access, quality jobs, and access, quality healthcare. And those are my focuses, and I'm looking forward to your questions tonight.
Great.
All right. Thank you very much. Folks, if you have a question, please press star 3 on your keypad right now. And we have a poll question for you. So let's see, we're going to have three poll questions tonight, and so we hope that you all participate. Do you think the state should close more tax loopholes? If yes, press 1. If no, press 2. Again, do you think the state should close more tax loopholes? Yes is 1, and 2 is no. All right. Thank you very much. And now we have our first question, and this is Sylvia, and she has a question about the state, the Senate budget. Sylvia?
Yes, thank you, and thank you all for doing this call tonight. I really appreciate it. I was just reading some things about the budget that came out over, I guess, in the Senate today, and I wondered if Senator Cleveland, as well as the representatives, had any comments to make about that.
Sylvia, thank you. That's an excellent question. I appreciate you asking it tonight. The Senate budget that was released today, I believe, is a good start toward those things that I feel need to be our top priorities. And those priorities are fully funding K-12 education so that we're sure we're meeting our constitutional obligation to fully fund our kids' education, and also fully expanding Medicaid in the state. So while those are priorities that are met within this budget, I'm not certain that that the budget is adequate in terms of meeting what we as Washingtonians have identified as our core values. So I believe there's a great deal of additional discussion that needs to go on to ensure that we are meeting those core values.
Well, Sylvia, thanks again for the question. I have a different take on it being from the House. I look at the Senate budget as basically what are the 10 biggest problems with the Senate budget? Why would you want to vote for that? Personally, I can go through the top 10 reasons why I wouldn't want to vote for the Senate budget. But just to, as a taster, I would think that number one would be the Senate budget adds even more tax exemptions to the tax code. I mean, here we are, we're trying to close tax exemptions. We've gotten a 50% plus one simple majority requirement, and adding tax exemptions to it just doesn't seem like a smart thing to do. And finally, another way would be the unconstitutionality of the school trust funds. In the Constitution, it says that certain universities have and schools get revenue from those lands to build school buildings, nothing else. The Senate budget sweeps those funds from the capital budget and replaces them with bonds, and I think that's unconstitutional. So I disagree with the good senator. I think it's a first step, a negotiating step, but I don't think that it's anywhere close to what we're going to need at the end of 25 days to get out of here.
Over the next week and a half, there will be several budgets that will be written about in the newspapers, and the remaining part of the session will be, we'll be discussing and the different priorities expressed in those budgets and the different spending. So if you hear something about one of those budgets that you like or don't like, it's really important that you send a message to your representatives and talk about it with people in your community, because that's an important part of the process too. None of those budgets will be the one that finally gets passed.
All right. Thank you very much. And folks, remember, if you have a question for your lawmakers, please press *3 on your keypad right now. And we're going to go with Bill, who has a question about Initiative 502, and another part of the question is about federal money for highways. Is that correct, Bill?
That's correct.
Okay, go ahead. Ask your question.
Okay. How much thought has been given, or has there been actual legislature that's out there for approval for regarding the 502 initiative? And I know some of the smaller communities that I've been to a few of these Washington State Liquor Control Board meetings, and they're not sure how that's going to, the federal funding is going, I mean, they could pull that funding is what their reservation or what their concern is. Has there been any dialogue to that effect?
Do you mean federal funding related to 502 or federal funding related to?
Federal funding related to highways.
The highway federal funding. That hasn't been discussed very seriously. There's a bit of uncertainty about how the federal government will react. There's a lot of folks that think that as long as we don't overproduce and have it spill over our borders where it becomes interstate commerce, the federal government is likely to stay out of the way, pretty much. Some people disagree with that, but that's what a lot of folks think. And so we're trying to be very deliberative and to meet the letter and spirit of the initiative, and still stay within reasonable boundaries. It's a fascinating process, and the whole world is watching, and there is no model to copy. When Prohibition ended, there was a distribution model to go back to, but there is nothing like that that's legal that exists right now.
And we're going with Polly, who has a question about Obamacare. Polly?
Yes, I was wondering, my daughter's already on state insurance, but my husband and I are not, and we're not sure when we'll be able to acquire insurance soon. So what our question is how are we going to afford to have insurance?
Well, Polly, most of the so-called Obamacare or the Affordable Care Act will be gone through primarily by the state providing exchanges, and various different healthcare agencies such as Kaiser or Group Health or Premera would provide products that would go to the exchanges and hopefully would be able to provide those insurance products to people who have never been able to afford care before. Many of those care plans will be subsidized by the state and by the federal government. So that's part of what the expansion of Medicaid was about, to 136% of the poverty level, which I believe. So there's some question right now of anybody who's currently on state-assisted or completely state-funded healthcare will be transferred over to an exchange. In addition to that, hopefully we'll be expanding the coverage to include people who have never been able to afford healthcare before. And this will be subsidized through the state and federal government.
This is the 49th Legislative District Telephone Town Hall with Representatives Jim Moeller and Sharon Wiley and Senator Annette Cleveland. If you're just joining us, please press star 3 on your keypad if you have a question for your lawmakers. And remember, we have a poll going. Do you think the state should close more tax loopholes? 1 for yes and 2 for no. And we're going to go now with Patricia, who has a question about, I'm not exactly sure, tunnel, Patricia?
Yes, a tunnel. Why build a bridge? Well, you know, all this argument over the height and et cetera, and the bridge, the tunnel that was built between England and France has been very successful, and the one between San Francisco and Alameda went through that earthquake, not a problem at all. So, consequently, I feel, well, then why don't we just build a tunnel type of road between Vancouver and Portland?
Patricia, this is Sharon Wiley, and that is an excellent question, and it's a question that I my family members and myself keep asking, and what I've been able to discover is that the process took a long time, and about 70 different options were evaluated, and the main problem with the tunnel is that the slope to get down deep enough for the shipping lanes has to start way north and end way south, and then you still have the problem of getting on and off of Hayden Island. Plus the cost per foot of boring is tremendous. And so when the process was started and they looked at the tunnel, there were lots of other options that looked more promising. And you know, I think it's natural to look at the great tunnels of the world, including the one in Vancouver, B.C., and say, this isn't so bad, but the process included a lot of evaluation of costs. There were a lot of community members that looked at those different options and chose a different one. So those of us who would wish for a tunnel would still, if we had a tunnel, we'd still have to repair that bridge at great expense in order to find, you know, to have that local access as well. So you're not the only one asking the question.
Patricia, this is Senator Annette Cleveland. I would add that that's a question that I've asked as well. My husband and I happened to be visiting London in the early 90s when the tunnel was being built, and we're very much aware of a lot of the discussion that was going on around that tunnel, and as you probably well know, there were those in Britain who were up in arms that this tunnel would bring riffraff and vermin to their country. And as you indicated in your question, obviously the tunnel has been very positive for both countries.
Folks, if you're just joining us or you have a question for your lawmakers, please press star 3 on your keypad right now. And let's look at the poll that we just did. Do you think the state should close more tax loopholes? 80% of you think that yes, the state should close more tax loopholes, and 20% say no. All right, so we're going to go now with James or Jim, who has a question about the safety net.
Yes, good evening. My question is about the safety net. It seems like it gets more and more porous with each budget. And right now we have people who are in wanting to get into drug treatment rehab, and there's no facilities. There isn't any seats for them or beds, whatever you want to call it. You know, I just wonder when the legislature is going to step up and really start funding the social network.
Well, Jim, that's an excellent question. I'm going to rail against a little bit about the Republican budget that was released in the Senate today. Quite honestly, I was appalled at sort of unconscionable cuts that were made to the social safety net. The aged, blind, and disabled were basically thrown under the bus. They're are jeopardizing the elderly and disabled. The Senate budget's cuts critical housekeeping and shopping services. I mean, $10 million from them, $51 million from the aged and blind disabled. Those are all part of our safety net. The specifics that you call out regarding chemical dependency treatment are very real. We have a relatively robust chemical dependency treatment programs in locally that can be accessed, but quite honestly, it comes down to dollars. And up here in Olympia, we have a zero-sum game. If I give it to you, it means I've taken it from somebody someplace else. So we only have so many dollars, and if we're going to fund everything that we want to fund, particularly since we've under the gun with the Cleary decision regarding education, we're going to have to look for some new revenue. And the Senate budget just doesn't look for new revenue. It doesn't look for revenue at all, as a matter of fact. And I think it's unconscionable what we've done to some of our social service safety net.
And, Jim, I got into this job because I didn't want to see any more cuts for the social safety net. I agree that we need to fund schools, but hungry, homeless children whose parents can't get treatment can't learn. And so I believe that we are all in this together, and that if we kid people and tell them that we can do all these things without it costing money, we're lying. And it's our job to try to tell the truth.
Folks, if you have a question for your lawmakers, please press *3 on your keypad right now. We're going to go with Mike, who has a question about Braille books. Mike?
Yeah, hi. I'm Mike Freeman, president of the National Federation of the Blind of Washington. Jim and Sharon, you know me. I do not haven't had the pleasure of meeting Ms. Cleveland yet. My question is this. The Washington Talking Book and Braille Library is the regional library for the blind in our state. It's under the Secretary of State's office, and over the last few years, it's taken something like a $600,000 cut, more cuts than many other agencies have taken proportional to their size, and I would like to know what steps you're going to take to put that money back so that we can resume some of the services that had to be curtailed or eliminated in order to stay within the budget.
Well, Mike, you know, this is Jim Moeller. Mike, you know that both the School for the Blind and School for the Deaf reside in the 49th District. And in fact, my predecessor, specifically with my seat, Val Ogden, started the Braille Library down in Vancouver, Washington. So this is an issue that I think affects all of us as state legislators, not only from the 49th, but also around the state. We are, of course, the House budget comes out much later next week than the Senate budget has recently come out. I can't speak specifically about the Braille Library as its results in the Senate budget, but I can tell you this, that we are not going to let these unconscionable cuts, what I call these ghost cuts, the ghost revenue, basically to permeate the House budget. And we will be working towards restoring those dollars as much as possible. It's going to take some revenue, Mike. That's the rub. And if we come in right now, the governor's proposed $1.3 billion in closing tax loopholes. And if we come in at $200 million, I think that we might as well just close up shop and go home, because we've gone, basically we're just saying we give up. We need to come in and we need to close some of those loopholes that are not being used anymore and have been slated for by the JLAR Commission and by the Citizens Commission to say close these loopholes. We need to do that, and we need to spend that money not only to fund our education, but also replace some of the dollars that have been sorely missed over these years.
And Mike, this is Sharon. There's over 600 tax loopholes, and I think it's about $30 billion worth. So something like that. And many more are on the table, as far as I'm concerned, than what it's so far been in any of the budgets. And I think that we need to get everybody talking about it.
Mike, this is Senator Annette Cleveland. I would just add to the comments by saying that, you know, this is an issue of fairness. I think that all of us have to do everything that we can to help support one another, and closing loopholes is the only just thing to do, rather than once again cutting services to our most vulnerable citizens.
I think one more thing in terms of loopholes. Those loopholes exist because we have an awkward tax system that isn't like most tax systems, and so those loopholes came into existence because of trying to balance that system. And I think going forward, we have to look at what kind of system would be fair, sustainable, and adequate.
All right. Thank you very much. Folks, if you're just joining us, this is your 49th Legislative District Telephone Town Hall. And we're taking your questions. Please press star 3 on your keypad right now if you have a question for your lawmakers. We have another poll going. Let's see. Should out-of-state shoppers pay the sales tax so that the state can invest more in our schools? If you think that that is the case, press 1, and no, press 2. Again, should out-of-state shoppers pay sales tax so that the state can invest more in our schools? Yes, 1, no, 2. And we're going with Arlene, who has a question about misuse of welfare money. Arlene?
I work in the retail system here in Washington State, and I have seen so much abuse with food stamp EBT cards, where people use their cash on things that, to me, like putting your money in a lottery machine. And Mr. Mueller had said earlier something about taking from and giving to. And I think that's what our system does, because we don't specify where the dollars should be spent by people who are receiving them. I don't understand why they can buy a $23 birthday cake versus buying 2 big boxes of cake mix and a couple of things of frosting for a birthday party. And those are just a couple of the things that I see ongoing.
Arlene, I'm not really sure what you were referring to as far as what you associated with me, but regardless of that, the abuse of EBT cards are a serious issue. And I can assure you that we have a fraud division of DSHS that's looking into episodes of fraud when those have come true. And they're investigated. So, but it depends, of course, on all of us to step up to somebody and say, wow, I didn't know that you could do that with an EBT card, putting it into a slot machine. I think that they've closed that ability to do that. But if you're seeing that still, then somebody is cheating, and they need to be reported. Other aspects as far as misuse or abuse of the EBT cards, I certainly would be willing to take any information that you have to share with me and investigate it and turn it over to for casework and turn it over to the department.
All right. Thank you very much. Folks, if you have a question for your lawmakers, please press star 3 on your keypad right now. And also, please answer our poll. Here goes again. Should out-of-state shoppers pay sales tax so that the state can invest more in our schools? If you think that that would be a yes, then press 1. And if no, then press 2. And we're going with Terry, who has a question about higher education.
Hello.
Hi, Terry. Go ahead. Ask your question.
Yes. I just heard a rumor that the Washington State Legislature was introducing legislation that the entry level for nursing practice in the state of Washington was going to be a 4-year Bachelor of Nursing degree. And it concerned me because we're in a state of shortage of nurses altogether. And we have a very good system in the state of Washington of two-year nursing programs in community colleges. I'm just wondering whether this was just one of those rumors or whether the legislature was serious about it.
Thank you for the question, Terry. I serve on the Higher Education Committee, and we have a lot of real in-depth conversations and look at a lot of research on what kinds of degrees and training are necessary. And I believe we are working on a bill that is probably already passed on to the Senate to make it easier for instance, military personnel who've worked as medics to get into to not have to duplicate their training and to move into nursing. In a lot of medical professions, there does seem to be a trend towards degree inflation, and we're trying to keep a close eye on that and making sure that there's a range of appropriate healthcare certifications and professionals to address our needs. There is a nursing shortage, and a bigger concern is the lack of funding for the spots. There's qualified people and jobs waiting for them in the nursing profession, and we don't have enough slots available. So I appreciate your question, and I'll keep an eye open for that. But I don't think that's not cast in stone. I think there's still non-four-year degrees in the nursing professions that exist. The trend, though, is to get more and more education because the complexities are there.
And, Terry, this is Jim Muller. I sit on the healthcare committee. I have not heard that, and that's, I think, a rumor that you've been subjected to.
And I would second that, Terry. This is Annette Cleveland. I also sit on the Senate Healthcare Committee, and that is not anything that we've discussed. And as you well know, with federal health reform implementation, the focus is going to be on integrating care and creating a care team where each member of that team operates at the top of their license. And that's going to require creating a full team of folks with all levels of experience and expertise.
All right, you're just joining us. You are with the 49th Legislative District Telephone Town Hall. Please press star 3 on your keypad if you have a question for your lawmakers. And let's see the results of our latest poll. Should out-of-state shoppers pay sales tax so that the state can invest more in our schools? 68% of you say yes, the state should charge sales tax to out-of-state shoppers, and 32% of you say no. And so now we're going to go with Harry, who has a question about coal trains. Harry?
Yes, this is Harry Anderson, and I've been concerned about the status of the proposal in regard to having these coal trains coming down from Montana loaded up with coal and no covers on these trains. So, in effect, coal dust could be flying all over our atmosphere, totally polluting our atmosphere and the ground and the rivers and so forth. And that's my main question. What is the status and how do we stop these trains from coming across country with no covers on them?
Thank you for the question, Harry. At this point, that is not up to the legislature, but both the Oregon governor and our own governor are forcing a higher level of environmental impact evaluation and research up front on what the impacts are. And so that's a work in progress. You'll probably be reading the same things as I will be in the newspaper, but there isn't anything before us right now because what's happening is pushing back to make sure that the issue is studied so that there's evidence of what the impact is.
Thank you very much. Folks, if you have a question, please press star 3 on your keypad right now. And let's see, we have a third poll. Here we go. Are you ready? Do you or anyone in your family use public transportation to go to Portland at least 3 times a month? If that is the case, then press 1. And if no, then press 2. And now we're going to go with Penny, who has a very specific question about Senate Bill 5242. Let's see, Penny?
Yes.
Hi. Go ahead and ask your question.
All right. I'm a teacher, and I've been teaching for quite a long time, and it's my understanding that Senate Bill 5242 is presently in the Education Committee. And I'm very concerned about this particular bill because it's a deceitful attack on teachers, on basic fairness, and it puts every teacher at risk of losing their job. And I'm very concerned about that. As a teacher who's been teaching for so long, I would really hate to see many of the teachers that are starting out, plus those that have my experience, lose their job over hearsay or, you know, no fairness towards what's going on. And so I'm just kind of curious as to how it's going in the particular education bill. Are they taking it serious? Are they going to drop it or just rewrite it? I'm very concerned about how this is being dealt with.
Well, Penny, this is Jim Moeller, and I've heard a number of people who have expressed a lot of concern about this particular bill. Senate Bill 5242 is currently in the House Education Committee, and it's going to be heard, or it has been heard, by Sharon Tomiko Santos, as I understand it. I think there is, unfortunately, somebody who is taking this seriously. The issue, as I understand it, is principals going after teachers. And at the same time, the other side of the coin is bad teachers who have been shuffled off on other school districts, other schools, essentially taking one for the team, quote unquote. And any of us who have worked in the private sector, we're used to that. But at the same time, so that's a real issue. So how do we address that? That's, I think, the question is. But I'm not really sure that this is a specific bill that's going to be passed. But it is being considered. And if I were a teacher and a educator, I would be concerned about this particular bill, and I would be communicating my concerns to Chair Santos about what specifically you would like to see changed, if at all.
Remember, press star 3 on your keypad right now if you have a question for your representatives and your senator. And regarding our poll, let's see, we asked, do you or anyone in your family use public transportation to go to Portland at least 3 times a month? If you agree that that's the case, please press 1. If no, then press 2. We're going now with Christopher, who has a question about the Columbia River Crossing Project.
Yeah, hello. My name is Christopher Berg. I'm wondering what the progress is being made on the I-5 Columbia River Bridge revision, and why does Washington seem to be stalling when Oregon has already come up with their half of the funds for this project?
Christopher, that's a good question. This is Senator Annette Cleveland. Thank you. I see this project, pure and simple, as being one that if we replace this antiquated drawbridge that currently spans the Columbia River between Oregon and Washington, the single most important, I think, economic investment we can make for our future. And the opposition to the project seems to be primarily around the mode of transit that's been chosen and the cost. But I remind you that this is a mega project. That's why we call it so. And the discussion and negotiation that's gone on around this project has taken well over a decade, and we are at a defining moment, I call it, for our community, in that we have to decide this year whether, as you say, Washington's going to step up with our $450 million in funding for the project. Oregon has stepped forward with their $450 million. Federal government indicates there's $850 million or more available for the project, and it's time to move forward and make a decision. I frankly feel it's time that we end the gridlock on the bridge and about the bridge.
It's time to build a bridge.
And we're going with, I'm not sure if it's Carl or Lori. Can you hear me?
I'm Lori.
Hi, Lori. And you have a question about more money for schools, correct?
I am a resident of the Battleground School District who did not pass their levy, and I'm anxious to know when will education be fully funded so that none of us have to hold our breath every other year whether or not we're going to pass a levy and have good school.
Lori, I enjoyed meeting with some of the folks from your Battleground School just this week. A lot of people have come up asking for help, and I think that I share the priority to make sure that we put a lot more money into our schools so that the partnership between the local school districts and the state is stable, and the schools are funded the way we, you know, the adequate funding for schools was defined through several very rigorous studies by the legislature over a period of time. So the court is holding us accountable for our own work, and it's time for us to put that money into schools. And I'm there. We will all be looking at a budget that will have some compromises in it, but I won't be able to support a budget that doesn't do a lot more than we've been doing to help our schools. But at the local level, you need to keep trying, because people vote against taxes without fully understanding what the impacts are, and I'm really hoping that Battleground makes it over the hurdle this next time.
Folks, we have about 15 minutes left of this call, so if you have a question for your lawmakers, please press star 3 on your keypad right now. And we're going to go with Bob, who has a question about businesses and boosting tax revenue. Bob?
Hi, this is Bob. I'm been listening not just to this call, but an avid citizen involved in his government, and I am seriously concerned. The overriding voices and conversations seem to be managing tax revenues and things going into the government, and I'm not hearing very much about what brings those taxes to the government, which are good jobs, increasing jobs, and bringing citizens from other states to participate in our economy. That would expand the tax base and revenues that we seem to be dwindling and having precious few of. What is being done to encourage business growth in a free enterprise, and I'm not saying government-oriented, but truly bringing people and expanding businesses that aren't attached to government, because that's what generates the revenues to create government jobs, too.
Hi, Bob. This is Sharon, and I've learned a lot by being on the Economic Development and Technology Committee. Our state is a leader in some certain areas of employment, exporting technology, agriculture and agricultural products, and biotech. Those are the growth industries of the future, plus all the normal jobs and businesses that support our communities. And we have brought in a lot of experts and talked directly to a lot of successful businesses from inside the state and outside the state. And what we hear are that they want employees that have a good work ethic and the right kind of training, whether it's a one-year degree, a two-year degree, or a graduate degree, and they want infrastructure and schools, and those are the things that government can do, is making sure that there is infrastructure and that we do invest in our education, and we do the very best we can at staying out of the way. Other things that we're doing as government is making it a whole lot less complicated for businesses to get started and to And one of the things that I would love to be able to work on is making it less onerous with our B&O tax on startup businesses. So we are looking at what nourishes those businesses that aren't going to die and that are going to be here in the future, and we're doing the things that government could do and should do to try to make those grow.
We're going with Jim, a question about the Second Amendment.
I had a question on where everybody's stance was, keeping in mind that the Second Amendment, was never set up for hunting or target practice, but more so to protect us in the event that the federal government ever did become tyrannical. Wanted to know where everybody's stance was on the recent push to kind of infringe on a weapon that is less than 1% of the actual issue that they're trying to protect.
Well, I think, this is Jim Mueller, my personal belief is, I currently own shotguns. I inherited them. And I use them for hunting. Regardless of whether you think that the Second Amendment was set up for personal defense or whether it was set up for hunting, regardless of that, I think that everybody should play by the rules. Essentially, if we're requiring people to have gun background checks when they buy or purchase a gun from a gun store, then we should require that from private sales too. I mean, quite honestly, if you're going to be requiring it from one, then you should require it from all.
This is Sharon, and I tend to agree with Jim, but I also believe that the Constitution says well-regulated militia, so I believe a certain number of regulations are reasonable.
And I'll add, this is Senator Annette Cleveland, that I absolutely support our Second Amendment rights, but we also have to recognize that we've seen some tragic incidents recently in our nation, in our state, even in our own backyard in Clark County. And I believe we need to have a broader conversation about not just gun safety and education and universal background checks, but also in ensuring that we have the services there to help those with mental health issues. And
absolutely,
it goes back to some of the questions we've heard earlier tonight in terms of fully funding the social service, the safety net. When we cut services like mental health, unfortunately, we then have to take responsibility for some of the consequences of that.
So we have 10 minutes left of this call, and we're going to go with Richard, who has a question about the bridge. Richard?
This is Richard Brumman. After the fiasco we had here last week where both bridges were plugged up, and they were plugged up until at least 10, 11 o'clock in the morning, why have we not considered building a low-level bridge out Kamishwashugal Way, which is the growing community, and the truckers can use that to get over to Troutdale and on to 24. It leaves another option without all of the money that's going to be spent, this level bridge that's going to eat up both Aden Island and over here in Vancouver.
Thanks for the call, Richard, and the question. Primarily, yes, a third bridge was looked at as an option, and it was looked at and thoroughly examined and was discarded as not a viable option. And the reason why is pretty simple. Oregon has to agree. I mean, this is not just a Washington project. This is a compromise project between the state of Washington, the state of Oregon, and the federal government. And Oregon doesn't agree to a third bridge. In fact, maybe sometime later when we're old and gray and we've got grandkids and we're swaying on the front porch swing, but not now, and not in the foreseeable future do we have the option of a third bridge. We have the option right now in front of us of a replacement bridge for the current I-5, which seems to be the problem.
Well, in addition to that, Richard, I would add that it's also a question of economics. The Interstate 5 corridor is obviously the most significant north-south freight corridor on the West Coast. And, you know, it links the Western United States with regional and national and global markets, really. So almost $40 billion worth of freight crosses that interstate bridge every year. And time is money, as you know. And if trucks were to have to bypass and we were to have to build another way for them to access the third bridge, again, that just adds to the cost of moving those goods. So our only option is to replace that antiquated drawbridge that, as many have said and pointed out, is literally the only stop sign on an interstate highway in our country.
And then there's the approaches and the entrances and exits that have to be replaced, too, which is a large part of the cost.
All right. Thank you very much. We have around 7 or 8 minutes left of this call, so we're probably going to go with one more question. We have Sandra, who has a question about more money for social services.
Hi.
Sandra?
Hi. I'm on Social Security Disability, and I get my health care through, I guess it's welfare, I'm not sure. But over the last 3 or 4 years, they've been taking away stuff, and things that we need, are desperate for, and now it's even come to the point where the insurance that we're put through is denying us some of our medications, and I don't know who's taking care of this. I know it's coming through the state, but it's just really bad, and the doctor prescribes certain medications. How does the insurance company deny that type of medication or how much you take? And that's what they're doing now. I mean, they took away other things like, you know, a diabetic could get shoes every 2 years. They took that away a long time ago. And
all right, Sandra, I hate to cut you off, but we're really running. We have very little time left, so I'm going to let the lawmakers answer your question, okay?
All right.
Hey, Sandra, this is Jim Mueller. Thank you so much for the question, but regarding, you're currently on Social Security Disability, and you currently get Medicaid, I presume, which is a shared program with the federal government. Every dollar that the feds put in, we put in a dollar. Recently, we've been trying to cut our costs at the state level by limiting the amount that we're willing to pay, not only durable medical equipment like those diabetic shoes that you mentioned, but also payment for dental prevention and dental repair has also been limited, if not eliminated. So the question is, will this be restored, basically? We're hoping that it is. The Senate budget currently does not do that. In fact, it takes even more money from the aged, blind, and disabled are basically thrown under the bus. And that's not what we're going to do in the House. Can I give you specifics on how we're going to go about doing that? Well, I can't give you any specifics right now, but, you know, stay tuned for the next 25 days because that's what we've got left for in this session, and it's going to get real bumpy here pretty soon.
All right. Thank you very much, folks. That is all the time we have for tonight. If you did not get a chance to ask your question, please do stay in the line because you'll be able to leave a message for your 49 legislative district lawmakers at the conclusion of this town hall. So thank you for joining us, and here are your lawmakers with closing remarks.
Thank you. And I would just like to thank everyone for taking the time this evening to join us for this hour and asking their questions. We didn't get to everybody, but we certainly, and when we don't know the answer, we'll be glad to look that answer up and get back to you as much as we can. So please stay on the line, and I'm going to turn it over to my colleagues.
Well, to Senator Annette Cleveland, and want you to know what a great privilege it is each and every day to be here representing you in Olympia, and I'm grateful that you took time out of your busy schedules to join us tonight and share your perspective, your thoughts, your questions. It's absolutely critical to our ability to be effective for you that you continue to communicate with us. So I would encourage you to continue to be engaged and don't hesitate to contact us at any time. Thank you.
And this is Sharon. It's always great to hear from people back home. It gets a little crazy up here sometimes, and we're going to be getting into the hard part of this job where we have to figure out if we're going to be able to support a final budget. And I came here because I wanted to make sure we funded education, that we did everything we could to produce jobs, and that we didn't keep eroding our social safety net, because there's a lot of evidence that shows that a lot of the things that we do to keep elderly people in their homes, to keep people well and healthy, and to get people drug and alcohol treatment save us money in our local jails. They save us money in family anguish. And I believe that it's our job to really fight hard for those folks and to speak up for them. And it's we are all in this together, and we need to keep talking to each other. Thank you so much for being on the line and for caring enough to interact with your government, because that's what we're here for. Thank you.
Thank you.